Welcome to NALP Talk, the official podcast for the National Association for Law Placement. My name is Scott Love, your host, and today we're talking with Daniel Thies and Tony Waller about a really interesting concept, a really interesting program within the American Bar Association. It's the Council of the American Bar Association section of legal education and admissions to the bar. And Daniel Thies is a shareholder at Weber & Thies in Champaign, Urbana, Illinois, and his practice focuses on litigation, insurance law, business representation, and estate planning. And he is the chair of this council. We're also joined by Tony Waller. He presently serves as the Assistant Dean for Career Development at the University of Georgia School of Law. He's the past president of NALP and has been active on the ABA NALP Employment Outcomes Reporting Advisory Group, among many other volunteer roles. Daniel, Tony, thank you for joining me on the show today.
It's great to be here. Thank you, Scott.
Hey, good to be here, Scott.
Great, terrific. Well, let's get right into this, Daniel. Why don't you tell our listeners about the mission and purpose of the council?
Sure. The council is recognized as the national accreditor for law schools in the United States. And traditionally, law school accreditation has not been the most glamorous of topics. When it's working well, you don't hear much about it. But recently, it's received a lot of attention. And there are good reasons for that in this case. National accreditation for law schools is a vital part of the rule of law. It ensures a consistent supply of quality lawyers able to meet the public's legal needs and to make the rule of law function. So we've been playing this role as a national accreditor since 1921, and we've been recognized by the Department of Education since 1952. The results of our accreditation speak for themselves. Graduates of schools that are accredited by the council pass the bar exam at rates about three times higher than those who graduate from schools that are not accredited by the council. Council graduates also have better career outcomes and lower disciplinary rates than do graduates from other schools. And we achieve these standards, or these results, by setting minimum standards for our approved law schools and then conducting regular site visits to law schools to evaluate their compliance with those standards. And to do that, we have 21 council members and hundreds of site visitors, all of whom are volunteers. They don't get paid for this. And combined, they spend tens of thousands of hours each year on these site visits and other council work in order to be able to produce our list of 197 accredited schools. The state Supreme Courts around the country then rely on that work when they're deciding who is eligible to pursue licensure in those states. So right now, if you graduate from a council accredited school, you can go to any state in the country and take the bar exam or otherwise pursue licensure in that state. So the council's work in that way ensures the portability of the law degree, meaning that you don't have to know where you're going to practice. When you apply to law school, you have that choice for you because you can still go to any state upon graduation. And that then, of course, becomes extremely important, as I'm sure we'll talk about, for the legal job market and the work.
Thank you for that summary, Daniel. And that's an interesting and an impacting way that you can absolutely touch the future by the work that you do. So tell me this. I know that there is confusion between the ABA and the council. How is the council different from the overall American Bar Association?
Sure. Well, I mentioned that the council is recognized by the Department of Education as the accreditor of law schools, and that's important. It is the council that's recognized, not the larger ABA. And one of the requirements that the department has for being recognized is that we have to be separate and independent from the larger organization. And that term, separate and independent, it's a term of art. It shows up in the Higher Education Acts. It's actually a requirement of the law. And practically, it really means three things about our separation. Number one, our budget is entirely separate from the larger ABA. So we set our own budget. We don't receive any money. We don't give in any money from our fees that we charge our accredited law schools. And so our money is entirely our own, and we make the decisions with respect to it. Second, policy. So the council has a final say on what the standards are and also on the accreditation results for any particular school. So those decisions are made just by the council. There's no appeal to the larger ABA or other three. And then third, personnel. So when the council is deciding who's going to be on the council, who our officers or leaders are going to be, that's an internal decision as well that the ABA leadership is not able to speak into. So in all those ways, we're separate three. And so if you hear about some sort of policy or action by the larger ABA, you can know that the council has had no say in it. We are separate and independent. We do our own thing and they do their own.
That's interesting. Thank you for elaborating on that, Daniel. Now, for both of you, Daniel and Tony, I understand that NALP and the council have had a very strong relationship over the years. What are some of the ways that they've collaborated?
I'll let Tony jump in if you'd like, but I'll say that NALP is a very close affiliate of the council, and we've worked closely with them for years. And actually, on a note of personal privilege, way back when I first got involved on the council, I was a law student member. One of our 21 members is a law student. And one of the people who really encouraged me and helped me grow as a member of the council was Jim Leichel, the former executive director of NALP. And, you know, I can give you some stories. I don't want to steal Tony's thunder, but particularly during the recession and leading into the career or the employment statistics verification projects that NALP and the ABA undertook during that time, the partnership was extremely important. I think really served the public and law school well in that era and making sure that the employment data was accurately being reported.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up, Daniel, because we can talk in a minute about the mandatory employment outcome reporting that the ABA requires law schools to collect, report, and the council requires us to post it to our websites under our required disclosures for consumers. But this is data NALP has been collecting for over 50 years. And one of the key values of NALP has always been to be able to collect accurate data to help law students make decisions about both law schools that they are considering and places they could go practice. That became a much bigger factor when the council decided to include employment outcome reporting as a mandatory reporting data point in 2012 or 13. Of course, because of the great relationship between NALP and the council, you know, the ABA relied pretty heavily on NALP in helping figure out exactly what should be asked and how it should be asked, which leads to one of the most important collaborations NALP and the ABA council has, which is the Employment Outcomes Reporting Work Group that you talked about earlier in my bio.
Now, Tony, you've also served on the ABA NALP Employment Outcomes Reporting Advisory Group for several years now. Before I ask you about that, can you briefly explain for our listeners who may be less familiar with employment reporting what that is and why that is important?
Yeah, as I mentioned, NALP has collected this data for over 50 years, and we have a treasure trove of that information. And it's more robust than what the council requires law schools to report, but the baseline is all accredited law schools are required to report to the ABA annually a snapshot employment number that's based on 10 months after graduation, typically around March the 15th, the year following graduation. So for the class that just graduated, all the schools will report what their employment rate is as of March 15th of 2027 for the class of 26. That is data you will see out on law schools' websites their 529 reports. They're a part of our reporting obligations to the ABA for our accreditation. Likewise, the ABA has, since they started collecting the data, they have a very good treasure trove of data that the schools have reported to them as a part of this. As far as Employment Outcomes Reporting Group goes, you know, we have worked closely with the ABA Council, I mean, we being now the law schools, to make sure that the questions they ask make sense. Because the council one of their functions, of course, is evaluating schools every 10 years now as a part of their accreditation process. But they may well put someone that works in the career development world or in student services or whomever on their site visit teams. The council, by virtue of being the accrediting body, doesn't necessarily have and does not have people who work in individual law schools. They have former law school people, but our relationship through the Employment Outcomes Reporting Work Group or Advisory Group has really helped smooth that relationship from people that do what I do on a day-to-day basis. And also, I think it's helped make the data that ABA is asking for more robust and more accurate, and probably most importantly, to law school consumers, students who are thinking about law schools, more importantly to them, has made sure that data is usable in a way that helped them make fine line distinctions about where they're going to make an investment for their legal education.
Can I jump in there and give a little bit of background from my perspective?
Go ahead. Go ahead, Daniel.
The partnership on this issue really, as I alluded to earlier, grew out of the recession when law schools were facing lots of pressure, both from declining enrollment ultimately, and then the job market as well, where the graduates are having a lot of trouble finding employment. particularly in 2009, 2010, 2011. I was actually the class of 2010 that Lehman Brothers failed the week that I was leaving OCI, right? So you're trying to interview with lawyers and they're steering around trying to figure out what's going on in the world and how their world is collapsing. So that was a pretty dramatic time. And again, pressure was on law schools, and there was no standardized system for reporting employment data. I know NALP had been collecting it for a long time, but there were still questions like, you know, if a graduate's working at Starbucks 10 months after graduation, how do they count in the statistics? Are they employed or not? You know, if a law school offers a $30,000 a year research assistant position to a graduate, does that count as employed? You know, if they're employed in the 10th month, but then it's a temporary employment appointment that ends in month 11, do they count as employed? All of those kinds of questions. And as you can expect, with the market pressures on law schools were answering those questions in all sorts of different ways. And the real value of the relationship at that time between the ABA and NALP and the council on NALP was that we were able to get this group together to talk about those issues and come up with a standardized set of answers, so that schools would be reporting their data consistently. And so then prospective students looking at the market would be able to compare apples to apples, not apples to markets. And I'd say, as an aside here, that this is really one of the great values of the national accreditor. You know, if we had multiple accreditors set up around the country or different states doing their own accreditation in different ways, it would be a lot harder to have a standardized set of data that prospective students could rely on. So that was an achievement, I think, of the partnership of NALP and the council that was enabled by the national accreditation status of the council at the time.
Yeah, and Scott, let me add one other little piece to that. Keep in mind that while the law schools have been reporting this data to NALP for 50 years, the important part of what Daniel just added is that it allowed law schools to operate with a uniform set of reporting. We have protocols. That's part of one of the things that Employment Outcomes Advisory Group advises the council on, or the reporting protocols. And while none of us, and I say this honestly, I remember the day that failed too at OCI at the University of Illinois, about 2 miles from where Daniel's office is now, because that's where I was working. And I remember, you know, we all faced immense pressure, and there are fine line distinctions that can be made. And NALP, as a member services organization, we trusted our membership to report data accurately and fairly. But at the end, we don't have police, and we don't have a stick or a carrot. Obviously, the carrot is being able to have accurate employment data longitudinally and across a single class year. But you know, the stick very much is, and probably should be, accreditation online if you're out there incorporating direct falsehoods to make sure you, again, it to me, it always has and always will come down to what we ask our students to pay, and are they getting the value added service out of it? And that's one of the things, stepping aside from the relationship with the council, is one of the things NALP does to make sure there are professionals running career development offices and professionals with great training who work in career development offices.
Great. Thank you, Tony. And thank you for that anecdote, Daniel. That's interesting. And Daniel, let me come back to you. I understand the council is undertaking a substantial review of the standards. Tell us about that process and what listeners can expect to see from the council.
Yeah. So the council, as I mentioned, it's a volunteer group. And so, you know, you talk to the 21 of us and get 21 different answers about our personal views on the accreditation. But we decided a few years ago that it was important that we as a group had articulated a definitive set of what sort of the core principles and values are that are driving us. We spent a lot of time on that statement. It's now available on our website. It's a 4-page document. So lots there, but it's basically a statement of what is important to us as we accredit law schools and what we are focused on. You know, things like serving the public, ensuring that graduates are competent to represent clients and to promote the rule of law, as I mentioned. And so that's a project that we completed about a year ago in August 2025. Once that was done, we didn't want them to just sit on the shelf and gather dust. So we took the next step of charging our standards review committee, or a committee that reviews the standards, with going through our standards book and making sure that the standards we have align with those core principles and values that we had articulated. And that project now has been going on for about 8 months. To help the standards committee in its work, I also appointed an advisory group, including representatives from state Supreme Courts as the consumers of our accreditation services, right? They're the ones who are relying on us to help them decide who's eligible for licensure. But then also including law school deans, and other academics to make sure that we've got the law school voice represented. And that group has now met a number of times, and they are helping us as we go through the standards to advise on where changes are necessary to maybe make sure that we're aligning our standards with those core principles that you've articulated.
So if listeners want to provide feedback on any of the standards, is there a way for them to do that, Daniel?
There is. And so every time that a change to a standard is proposed, we send it out for notice and comment, usually 30 or 45 days. And so anybody is welcome to write to us and tell us what they think of what we propose. In addition, once a year, and we've actually just finished the process this year, we send out a general request asking the public to tell us, where do you think we should make changes? You know, what standards need to be improved? What standards maybe could be deleted? And we get feedback from a variety of different groups on that topic. Also, throughout the year, we are incorporating more and more a variety of informal ways for people to speak to us, you know, town halls and opportunities for the public to address us. So more of that is coming, but we are always interested in what people have to say. And I said before, you know, if anybody wants to call me up and talk about the standards, I'm always happy to do that too. So, you know, my contact information is available on our law firm website. I'm not hard to find.
Great. Thank you. And recently, the council voted to repeal Standard 206, which was the diversity and inclusion standard. Can you tell us a little bit more about that decision?
Yeah. So one of the core principles, as you might imagine, of the council is that we don't require law schools to violate the law as they are seeking our accreditation, right? So if there's a standard that conflicts with the law in some way, you know, we recognize that schools don't need to violate the law to be less cert. And that's been embedded in Standard 206 for a long time. That is our diversity and inclusion standard, but it has an interpretation that says, you know, if you live in a state, which, you know, before SFFA versus Harvard included states like California and Michigan that prohibits affirmative action, you don't have to take the actions that violate that law in order to comply with it, right? So that's been clear from the beginning. Of course, then SFFA versus Harvard did come along, and the law on the national level changed in some respects, with respect to the consideration of race and admissions. And also, states across the country have been taking a variety of actions on their own, you know, putting different requirements, particularly on law schools that are part of public university systems in different states, changing what they can do with respect to DEI. So, first reason the council took a look at 206 and ultimately decided to repeal it is that we're surveying this landscape and deciding that, you know, to be a national accreditor, it's not good to have a standard that's applied differently in each state, depending on what their law is. And so we decided for that reason to repeal. The second big reason that was motivating us, and particularly motivating us to do it at this time, is our process that we're going through with the Department of Education. So I mentioned that we are recognized by the Department of Education as an accreditor. They review us every 5 years, which I'll point out is twice as often as we review law schools. That would be a credit. So we only visit them every 10 years, but we get scrutiny from the department every 5 years. And we're in the middle of that process, leading up to a hearing in September, where I'll go to Washington and testify in front of an advisory body called NASIKI. And then that process will lead to a recommendation that goes to the secretary's designee, who will make the ultimate decision on whether or not we continue to be recognized. So we're in the middle of that process. And of course, as good lawyers, as you might expect, we've been watching other people who are going through the process. And there are a couple of other accreditors who went to a hearing before us. And in March, the department made some decisions with those accreditors, and particularly in respect to their diversity and inclusion standards that are similar to our 206. And basically, to make a long story short, the department told them, you've got to repeal those standards in order to remain recognized. And so we see that. We know that something similar is coming to us. It's the same body that's advising and the same decision maker. And so we see the repeal of 206 also as a necessary step to make sure that we can maintain our recognition by the department, which then in turn helps us to remain the national accreditor and to ensure portability of our degree so that students can go and get a job in Brent.
Thank you. And let's talk about state-level changes. Tony, I'll get to you in a second. I have one more question for Daniel related to state-level changes. What are you seeing as the short-term and potential long-term impacts of the actions taken by Texas, Florida, Alabama around accreditation?
Sure. So I mentioned that we are the national accreditor of law schools. That's never meant that we are the only accreditor. And I'm sure lots of listeners are probably familiar with California's system. So they have a state-level accreditation system with a couple dozen of law schools, I think, who are outside of our ABA process. The graduates from those schools right now can only join the bar in California or maybe a couple of other states as well. So it's a sort of parallel system alongside council accreditation. And I should emphasize that that is not rare historically. If you look back from 1984 up until 2019, 39 different states had alternatives to the council accreditation process in place at some point during that period. So it's actually quite common for states to have these alternative pathways. And despite that, the council, as I mentioned, has maintained its status as the gold standard. So the statistics I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast about better bar pass rates, better career outcomes, and lower disciplinary rates for graduates of council accredited schools. Of course, you can only get that data if you've got other schools out there who are producing graduates who are not council accredited. And as I said, there have been a few dozen of them over the last 40 years. So it's actually a rich set of data where you can make comparisons like that. And so when you come to the actions in the recent years from Texas, Florida, Alabama, and others, you know, I really see them as in the same genre where states are welcome to experiment with their own alternative systems. Certainly, it's the state Supreme Courts that are ultimately in charge of who gets to be licensed. It's never been us that is in charge of that, and we don't want to be in charge of that. You know, we're staying in our lane of accrediting schools. And so as they experiment with other systems, you know, we welcome that. If they come up with an innovative way of doing accreditation that is a lot better than what we're doing, you know, I'm all ears. We always want to improve and change our system to make it better. But I expect that throughout that experimentation, we'll continue to be the gold standard. And largely it's because of the portability that I mentioned that our national accreditation provides, and also the data collection piece that we've already talked about too, that, you know, there is value in having a national accreditor, even with these other experiments and alternative accreditation systems going on at the same time.
Great. And Tony, as someone who's counseled thousands of students in their career planning, what are your thoughts on what states like Texas, Florida, and Alabama are doing?
Well, I mean, I think all of us in the career development world are keeping a close eye, especially if we also double as on the primary bar, the primary counselor on which bar exam to consider, because, you know, that does matter, especially if there comes a time where a law school has to undertake a separate accreditation in order to be eligible to sit for a bar exam in a jurisdiction like Texas, Florida, or Alabama, which of course would impact the University of Georgia, probably not as much as it would impact some other schools, but it would impact us. And I think what I'm really here, glad to hear Daniel say that, you know, they welcome the innovation, because I think all of us on the law school side, or most of us on the law school side, also welcome that innovation. But let me also be clear, I think the practice is safer for the public. I think the practice is better. I think law schools are better because of the work that the council has done for the past 50 or 60 years. And also, even though they're the bane of my existence from February to April because of employment outcome reporting, that's a net positive for the profession. It's a net positive for our students. It's a net positive for law schools. And as long as what is happening in these the state accreditation bodies, they keep in mind that what is, at the end of the day, it's about the students. It's about making sure students who make investments at their universities for their law school education, they keep that at the forefront and not ancillary things. I think I would have no problem with trying to figure out the best way to make that work. Again, keep in mind what Daniel said, the council is and will probably remain the gold standard because not only have they been and have an incredible head start, they are worried about the profession writ large.
Right, right. Thank you, Tony. And Daniel, you're also a practicing lawyer in addition to being chair of the council. What are you seeing as top issues facing law students and law schools right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a longstanding push and pull between the profession and law schools about how best to train lawyers, right? And this goes all the way back to apprenticeship days. And, you know, the ABA and the council really were founded in order to address the problem of having, you know, patchwork with different standards, right? When you've got lawyers apprenticing in different offices and you have educational standards, one for every office that they're apprenticing in, right? So there are a lot of advantages to apprenticing, you know, learning your craft at the end of a master lawyer, but it's hard to scale. Right. So that's been the problem from the beginning of the council existence that we've been trying to address. And I think it's become more acute in recent years, really since the depression, the recession, 2008 to 2011 or so, because law firms and legal employers aren't able to put as much into training new lawyers as maybe they could have 30 years ago. Clients certainly are not as tolerant of training new lawyers on their dime. And that's a problem because the law schools haven't, you know, been able to step in and fill that gap completely. Now, there's a lot they can do. And, you know, there's a debate, as I said, a push and pull between the profession and the academy about exactly where do we draw this line. But I'm encouraged because I see cooperation more and more. I think particularly the involvement of the state Supreme Courts around the country. We haven't talked about this yet, but they have a group called CLEAR, the Committee on Legal Education and Admissions Reform, that now is putting out its second report or working on a second report that's going to address accreditation. One of the things their first report said is that the Supreme Courts have an important role to play in making sure that the next generation of lawyers are being educated. And that's certainly true. So I think we're seeing the courts get engaged in the way that they haven't been, and the courts force them to bring along the rest of the profession in a lot of ways. So lawyers are getting engaged. They're realizing, again, I think the importance of having the practicing bar and the judiciary involved in legal education. And I think there's also a willingness on the side of the law schools to reach out and have those kinds of partnerships that will help ultimately promote better training. And I mentioned, you know, how we started kind of in the era of training through apprenticeship. In some ways, we're on the cusp of an era where that could come full circle and we could see more of apprenticeships being. So right now, the council standards really don't prohibit a law school from having a model where the third year is entirely apprenticeship, you know, with a few classroom components. That's allowed right now. And there are some schools that are doing, you know, and then at the same time, you've got the Supreme Courts that are considering things like admission by practice programs as an alternative to the bar exam, right? So that's moving you towards an apprenticeship model as well. So I think there's the opportunity to really have a partnership where we're training lawyers better because all of the stakeholders are engaged. And the council's really focused on making sure that we don't get in the way of that, right, with our standards, and that we're allowing that to happen in the best way possible.
Great. Thank you, Daniel. And our final question for you, Tony, what other issues are you seeing from your vantage point at the University of Georgia?
Well, I mean, there are two things that come to mind, and one of them was brought up by Daniel, which, of course, is the concept of how practice-ready law students are. I think the one thing I would encourage anyone thinking about this is that we are transitioning from a model where law firms didn't want too much hands-on training because they wanted to train their own lawyers primarily. Well, there are a couple reasons for that. The super cynical reason from my standpoint is clients would pay for it, so why not? The less cynical is that really wasn't what we're not trade school, right? Law schools are not trade schools. But that model is changing, and the schools that are best rising to the occasion to make sure their students are practice ready or close to practice ready are going to be the ones that will be most successful across a broad spectrum of skill sets. That's one of the reasons why I think a lot of schools are now looking at, there have been some practice or simulation practice requirements, but are actually incorporating that a lot more into practice. I mean, the University of Georgia, nearly 100% of our students graduate with at least one set of experiential learning or practice simulation, like an actual talking to clients and dealing with clients on some level. And that the University of Georgia is not unique in that standpoint. I guess the second thing I would say is that students are becoming more and more interested in not being locked down to one jurisdiction. And part of that is now, over the past 15 years, that's become more likely with the UBE becoming more ubiquitous. The other part about that is just, that's also generational. You know, when I went to law school, it would be highly unusual for someone to take more than one bar exam. Why would you go through the hassle of doing that? You know, you might practice for a few years as law school, as you know, jurisdictional portability became a lot more easy to do as you got more practice experience. The reality is we work with students now who are going into their second and third year, still not certain where they want to practice. The lag time on a bar exam and being licensed does require some forethought, but I think one of the big changes that will happen in the practice over the next 25 years will be the winnowing of, there will always be states that want to do it differently, but there will also be business or economic advantages to states that figure out ways to allow accredited law students who've been accredited to practice law or attorneys who've been accredited to practice law in another jurisdiction to simply come over and practice in your jurisdiction. And that gets right back to the council and the value of having nationwide standards that all law schools can rely on, all law firms can rely on, all jurisdictions can rely on, and the public can rely on to make sure students are meeting those quality standards when they graduate and walk across their stage.
Great. Well, thank you, Tony Waller and Daniel Thies. Thank you both for sharing your insight on this important topic on the podcast.
Yeah, thank you, Scott. And I'm grateful for the partnership with NELT. And thank you, Tony, for a good conversation. I'd love to have a lot more time to chat with you and hope we get to in the future.
Same, Daniel and Scott. Great to talk with you.
Likewise. Take care. Thank you so much.